You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 9th to the 15th of July 2015. My name is John Elms and I'm joined today by reporters Ellie Bothwell, Jack Grove and Matthew Rice. External examiners should be appointed centrally by an independent body rather than recruited directly by institutions themselves. Those are the recommendations of a new study. Jack has the full details on that story and he'll be covering that in a little bit. A new pilot ranking by Times Higher Education has given a snapshot of the leading performing HE nations in Africa. That is based on research influence, and Ellie has been analysing the data on that one. Playing pranks, town and gown issues, and clashes with authorities. They sound like things that students get up to at universities currently, but Matthew has been discovering that this can be tracked. This type of behaviour can be tracked back to the medieval times. You've been listening to a scholar who argues that this misconduct was far from simply hijinks, and there might be another reason for it. And finally, a news story that's proved very popular on social media recently. Jack has been talking to Baroness Amos, who is the first appointed, first black woman to be appointed to lead a UK university. She has been calling on the sector to emulate US efforts to increase diversity, and Jack will be filling us in a bit more with about his interview later. But first, Jack, your story on external examiners, it's quite an interesting one.
Yes, so this is part of the big shake-up of quality assurance taking place at the moment. And part of their plans focus on external examining, which I learned recently was set up, started when Durham University was founded about 200 years ago. They sent some academics up from Oxford to sort of guarantee that the standards at Durham were similar to that at Oxford. And it's sort of extended across the whole sector, so various external examiners visit other universities and make sure that there's a sort of consistency across the sector. But this report by the Higher Education Academy says that this isn't always the case. There's not really a sort of cross-pollination of external examiners and universities. So generally, external examiners for Russell Group universities come from the Russell Group. Those from teaching-focused universities tend to visit other teaching-focused universities. So there's a fear that you've got a sort of division within the sector and then you can't really compare standards. So this report is saying that instead of having universities appointing their own external examiners, you should have a central body that basically sends out their own external examiners, and it's an independent system, which would also eliminate what some people see as the rather cosy relationships, and also some of the uncertainty about what external examiners are meant to do. If you had a sort of professionally run central body sending out external examiners, telling them what to do, they would sort of do it in a more consistent way, which is one of the issues raised here.
And you mentioned in your story that it's also to ensure consistent marking practices, but institutions do have different exams. Isn't this going to be slightly problematic for the sector?
Well, the variability isn't so much about the exams; it's more about the role that people think that the externals should have. So some people see it as whether they should be sort of sitting in the corner just checking that certain processes have been followed. Others see their role as more as one to intervene and say, actually, no, I didn't agree with that, what you did there, or actually, does that person deserve this mark, or maybe you should give them more. So there's an uncertainty about how far examiners can intervene, and so that's the sort of variability that they're talking about. But that's difficult because universities want to sort of run their own degrees. They don't want someone from outside always coming in and sort of having the final say. So it's a difficult thing to get right, but they feel that the system's got a bit unwieldy, no one really knows what's going on in other parts of the sector, and it means that basically either 2-1 from Oxford the same as a 2-1 from Durham, or a 2-1 from Oxford Brookes or, you know, Greenwich or Brunel, because there's just the system seems to have sort of gone off into their own corners. The Higher Education Academy are saying then it's all got a bit, you know, it needs to be sort of made more professional.
And do you think that institutions will go for this? I mean, they probably wouldn't like to be called, the idea that they have these cosy relationships, that's a veiled criticism. I mean, it's using a soft word for something, you know, basically saying you're chummy, you're all
very chummy. But that's the thing is, external examiners, apparently they don't get that much money for doing this stuff. It's £300 to £600, I think, was the figure given in a recent report. So given the amount of work you've got to do, you've got to travel somewhere else for a whole, you know, for a week, you've got to do something that you really don't have to do. If you ask people then to, you know, to be trained, to have to go on a register, to do things in a way that they don't want to do, people might just say, actually, I don't want to do this, and the whole thing would collapse. So,
absolutely.
It's tricky.
Yeah, of course. Well, Jack's story can be found on page 8 of the magazine if you'd like to look at it in more detail. Ellie, you've been reporting on a new and experimental, if experimental, THE ranking. What have you found? We have a fair few THE rankings. What is this one about?
So this one is a sort of snapshot ranking for Africa. And it's not sort of an official ranking yet, but it's just kind of looking at, if we were to rank African universities just based on research influence, sort of how would they be ranked? I mean, the news from this is it's a top 15 table. The big news is that South Africa is just very dominant in the table. So the University of Cape Town is number one. It makes up more than half of the top 15 list. But I mean, you know, it is interesting sort of looking at the other countries that are appearing. So Morocco, is the second most represented nation. It's got two universities on there. Sort of Uganda, Nigeria, Kenya, Ghana, and Egypt all also make the list. But yeah, as I said, you know, we're sort of stressing that this is just a very kind of early draft of an Africa ranking, and it's more just a sort of spark of discussion at our Africa University Summit, which is at the end of the month.
Sure, exactly. And Phil, our rankings editor, he's quoted in it saying, when we develop a full Africa University ranking. Now, I don't know if you're inside Phil's head, but is that something that is on the cards?
Yeah, it's something that's on the cards. We haven't got a date or anything planned for that yet. So we don't know exactly when we'd have an Africa ranking. I mean, it won't be this year. I don't know if it will be next year at this stage. But I think the idea is to sort of see what appetite there is at the summit. I think the thing with African institutions is a lot of them kind of get overlooked in our main world university rankings. Some of them, you know, they only four, in fact, of the top 15 in this Africa list have been ranked in last year's World University Ranking.
Right.
And so it's just quite a useful way of seeing just within the continent how they stand up. But yeah, I can't tell you when we're going to have an official ranking yet.
And there was me thinking I was going to get an exclusive there. but no, absolutely. As you say, it's kind of building up to the Africa's University Summit. And what kind of... do you have an idea about what's on the agenda there, or is that top secret as well?
Yeah, no, we've got our programme has sort of already been highlighted about that. I mean, a lot of it will be looking at sort of the funding of higher education within Africa, sort of preventing brain drain from the region as well. I know that a lot of institutions in Africa are sort of teaming up with organisations abroad, so that students can go study abroad, but then they're sort of ensuring that they're then going to come back to Africa to work after they graduate. So it will sort of just be discussing sort of the main challenges of the region, really.
Yeah,
I've heard it said as well that some of the university in South Africa, particularly, they want to make their universities more African and less sort of trying to emulate the European model, which maybe doesn't work for some of their students, given the different challenges around this research and teaching that faces Africa as opposed to Western Europe. You can say, does their curriculum and all their research activities, does that, should that be based on a sort of European model or an African model?
I presume that the summit will shed light on a lot of those topics. And if you want to take a look at the story that Ellie's written in the rankings, that can be found on page 12 of the magazine. Now, Matthew, I had great enjoyment reading your feature.
Thank you.
And you've also written a blog about it. I mean, you've really been hitting this subject hard. It's based on student mischief from way back when, and you spoke to a scholar who's been researching this. But it's quite an interesting, what are the topics? What have you discovered?
Well, this is an academic, Hannah Skoda, who works at a medieval historian at Oxford, who's written about violence in the Middle Ages more generally, and now she's working on a project about student violence in particular, and comparing Oxford, Heidelberg and Paris. And it's a very serious analysis in all sorts of ways, a very interesting research. But there are also a good many funny stories. There's the story about the students in Paris who stole a huge stone which was known as the Devil's Fart. And one of the people involved was François Villon, one of the most famous French poets of the Middle Ages, and he claimed that he'd written a poem called The Romance of the Devil's Fart, which almost certainly, this was a joke, if it wasn't, it hasn't survived. was the pity. And there's stories about arguments over prostitutes, there's stories about people deciding to urinate out of chapel windows on the very day, the Feast of the Thousand and One Virgins, whatever that is, and so on. And so there's a lot of very interesting, very lively material. But I think there are two more, I think, more serious issues. One is Hannah sort of uses this approach called labelling theory, whereby if you decide that certain groups in society are more likely to commit crimes, they get more police attention, and then the statistics prove they commit more crimes, and they're sort of half tempted to try and to go against stereotype and half tempted to live up to them. And students in the Middle Ages, because they were clerics, they were sort of dismissed as sort of emasculated and feeble, but they were also thought as drunk and disorderly, that students always have, and so they were kind of trying to deal with these two stereotypes.
Yeah.
And I think she's saying that it's not just about students kind of having fun in the way that perhaps they always have, but there are more serious issues at stake. And indeed, the level of violence is actually quite shocking in some of these stories. There's some very funny stories, but there's some pretty horrific stories. And there's also the whole issue of universities and how they deal with their towns and countries they work in. And in Oxford, there was something called the St. Scholastica's Day Massacre, in which it was a dispute over watered-down wine, and which the students seemed to have started. But basically, the university won, and the town kind of came under the control of the university. And, obviously, there's no direct causal connection, but, it does make one think today the kind of privileges that students had. And she said, if a student in the middle of Oxford goes around, I don't know, making a noise with a bin or something, they might get ticked off by the dean. But if someone at the council estate down the road did the same thing, they might get an ASBO.
Yeah.
So this whole thing about the kind of privileges and the ways universities are kind of negotiating their relations with the state and trying to prove impact of one sort or another, sometimes by sort of in effect siding with one side in a civil war. That's another kind of violence she talks about. So there's all, I like to think there's certainly some good stories in her very interesting papers, and I've used them in my piece, but it's a very serious and interesting piece of research too.
Yeah.
some brilliant illustrations as well.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's a fantastically illustrated feature. But as Matthew says, although yes, there are some amusing stories about student antics in the time, the idea that this can inform how relationships between, say, universities and town and how they were perceived is an important one and will stand up in terms of context of today when students can be quite rowdy and some towns might suffer.
Yeah, I think there's some intriguing parallels interesting to reflect on.
Absolutely, exactly. Well, that's Matthew's feature is on pages 38 onwards, 38 to 41, I believe, in our magazine, and very well worth a read. It is a very interesting topic, as you have just discovered. Jack, you also did, it was released over the weekend online, and it proved very popular amongst our readers, an interview with Baroness Amos, who's just been made director of SOAS, University of London. And it's a very important appointment. She's the first black woman to lead a UK university. And she had some quite, important things to say about on being made director.
Yeah, well, she's just come back from New York, where she's been for the last 5 years working for the United Nations in quite a sort of senior post as a sort of humanitarian undersecretary and emergency coordinator, doing lots of stuff around Syria and Nepal and Yemen and the Philippines and all those things there. She was saying she was quite shocked to realise she would be the first black woman vice-chancellor or university leader, because in America there's quite a tradition there where you've got universities are run by black women, not just sort of specialist universities, mainly black students, but also Ivy League universities, major research universities. And this goes back almost 100 years, over 100 years, actually, you've had women running colleges and universities. So she thinks, we could learn some lessons from the US in that respect.
Yeah. And presumably, why has it taken England so long? Sorry, not just England, sorry, Great Britain, the UK, to appoint a black woman?
Difficult to say. I mean, obviously, America does have a larger black population as a percentage of the population. But there has been a big debate about whether, we are encouraging enough getting enough people into black people and ethnic minority people into the Russell Group University, into PhDs, and helping them become professors, which would then lead to more senior appointments. I think there was a conference I went to last year. It said there's only 85 black professors in the UK, of which only 17 are black women. So sort of interesting, really, how much the sector reflects the student population. It's a debate I'm sure Baroness Amos will be part of.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Jack's interview with Baroness Amos is on page 11 and is a very much recommended read. I'm afraid that's it for this week's Issue Review podcast. But as always, complete coverage of the latest HE news, features, culture and books can be found in the magazine and on our website. We also value your input as well. So if you'd like to comment on any of the content in this week's edition, you can find us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, and of course our website, timeshighereducation.co.uk. Please do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. Until next week, however, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.